All right, we're going to just back away from NPR News right now because joining us is Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. We have just a few minutes out of the mayor's busy schedule. Good morning, Mayor Garcetti. Thank you for being with us.
Of course, Larry. Thank you for everything you've been reporting.
You know, thanks. It's our pleasure to be able to, just as a team here, do what we can. Let me start, first of all, with any news since your news conference last night. Anything new to report early today?
No, we're awaiting, of course, always the numbers that come in each day. It's a grim reminder of what this is really about. But we have, since last night, been at the convention center, continuing to do everything we can. And we asked this morning for military assistance from DOD, the Department of Defense, to help us build out the field hospital that the county and other hospitals have clearly indicated they're going to need when the surge comes for too many patients and not enough beds. And, you know, the other message I think that's not new, but I'd like to underscore from yesterday is everybody has, you know, by and large done an incredible job of staying at home, physical distancing. But the second weapon in our arsenal is, of course, knowing when and how and where to isolate yourself. If you've either been exposed to someone that's, you know, now positive, if you yourself is positive, or if you have symptoms. And that household spread, and I know that's difficult depending on how tightly packed in people are, but it is absolutely critical, almost as critical as our physical distancing, to make sure we can slow the spread of this virus and keep a lot of vulnerable people out of our emergency room.
You mentioned setting up the L.A. Convention Center as a field hospital. The California National Guard is working on that. What kind of additional personnel are you looking at from the Defense Department?
So we have great help this weekend from the California National Guard that helped us unpack that crate sent to us by the United States Department of Health and Human Services. We're hoping to get more of them. We're hoping to get more people to help unpack that. And then we need personnel. You know, every last medical person right now in a hospital is at that hospital. And so to stand up a hospital from scratch, you know, the government sends you the equipment, but the equipment means nothing without the nurses and the technicians and the doctors. And we've got an amazing space at the convention center, hundreds of thousands of square feet that we can put if they ask us to take COVID-19 patients that have, let's say, lower symptoms, whether they want us to take non-COVID-19 symptoms or even other parts of the halls we can use to take some of our unhoused Angelenos off the streets to supplement the shelters we've been doing and, of course, the hotel and motel rooms that we're trying to lease up as quickly as possible. It really is pretty diverse, but we know that the Department of Defense can help us by getting that stuff up quicker and also by potentially offering us some of the medical units they have.
Mayor Garcetti, so we've got the Mercy, the U.S. Navy medical ship with 1,000 beds to take non-COVID-19 patients to relieve some of the stress on local hospitals. Any sense of the capacity of the convention center with COVID-19 versus non-COVID patients?
Well, the capacity is huge. I mean, the space is not the issue. You could have potentially thousands of beds in there and with proper spacing if they are COVID-19 patients. We've got two separate halls, which are basically separate from each other. So if we needed to seal off the bridge that connects them, one could be, you know, a distinct COVID-19 area. And you could even have the spillover for folks that are non-COVID-19 patients who can't find a bed in a normal hospital, though we do think in those cases, those folks need to go to hospitals that are specialized in things like trauma. And we're seeing, by the way, things like car accidents down quite a bit while people are stay at home, but we're seeing them be worse because people are speeding. Another thing for folks just out there listening, if you're driving, please slow down. But the convention center could have thousands. That it's not a space issue. It is a resources issue of both personnel and how much we can get in there from our federal government, how many ventilators we could have if we need that level of care. So I think we're starting with this 250 right now. The hospitals I'm talking to feel like they're all preparing for the surge. They're able within hospitals right now to expand capacity. Some like Cedars-Sinai have put triage tents on the outside and parking lots and things like that. And as much as we can keep that compact around already functioning hospitals, that's better. But the convention center will play a role, just as the U.S. naval ship Mercy is, to help that spillover. And we'll just take whichever orders from the medical professionals they need. it's kind of funny, Larry. I mean, the city of Los Angeles doesn't do a single thing really on healthcare, but we're learning how to stand up a hospital, hire doctors, get a hospital administrator, get beds, figure out ways to make sure there's medicine there. It's an amazing undertaking from so many brave volunteers who've just stepped up to say, sign me up, I'm here to help, and I know that it will relieve the hospitals quite a bit.
Mayor Garcetti, do you feel like Los Angeles is going to be facing the intensity of COVID-19 that New York City is, or do you think because the physical distancing measures went in comparatively sooner that could lessen the effects here?
I certainly hope it could lessen the effects, but I think it forestalls the effects of, you know, New York will probably still get worse, but it was really bad even a week ago. And I think it's inevitable that we get to a level of at least where New York was a week ago in a couple weeks. So, you know, everybody is looking for what's the next, you know, Iran was the next China, Italy was the next Iran, New York is the next Italy. Then there was all the coverage, could LA be the next New York? Well, my point with this virus is everywhere is the next. In Oklahoma, they were a day behind us per capita. Wyoming and North Dakota had the same levels that we did a few days ago when I made the calculations. The coasts get a lot of coverage because we have more people sometimes in our cities. But this virus doesn't care how dense you are. It might spread a little quicker in those places, but it will work its way through an entire population in rural areas. They're going to be affected as well and very hard hit. So this is both about the virus and how we live. It's also about our medical capacity. And it's kind of underscored just, I think, the failure of our country to prepare for a pandemic, to not have the stockpiles. And Larry, I wish this weren't the truth, but I do feel, and most experts I've talked to say, this isn't just going to be a one-time thing. Until we have a vaccine, it could be two or three times, probably in the fall. We'll see another spike or the early winter. And we better be prepared. We better look at this, you know, if you take the metaphor to, you know, World War II or something, there's a surprise at the beginning and people were caught off guard. But the next campaign, we better be building out. We better be ready to get the factories going. We better have the people hired. We better have the system set up. And we need national leadership. This is something that I'm so proud of what LA is doing to step up on, and other mayors that I've talked to and governors, you know, Republican governors like the governor of Ohio has done a great job. Democratic governors like our governor has done a great job. But we need to have, you know, national leadership at important moments that says we're going to put together all of the buying power of this country, the manufacturing might of this country, and we are going to help save lives. And right now, that's something that's really being done by the rest of the United States, not from our nation's capital.
Last night, Mayor Garcetti, apparently there were some people in cars outside the mayoral residence trying to urge you to put a complete ban on evictions into effect. What's your thinking about that?
I already have. I've said that nobody will be evicted during this, not just residential, but commercial tenants. I remind people that if you can pay your rent, do pay your rent, because our whole financial system and companies and jobs depend on that. But if you can't, because of COVID-19, you will not be evicted. So I understand how tough this is. What keeps me up at night after I, you know, think through the hospital capacity and the spread of this disease and the number of people who will die is just the economic suffering now in the short term, and potentially if we don't get this right in the long term. But we also have to be careful not to be completely impulsive about the solutions we come up with, that when this is done, we have no economy left. If I were in charge at the national level, I would have helped companies just pay all their employees, come up with a program to cover those who aren't employed by an employer, like in the gig economy, and I wouldn't have left our undocumented immigrants behind, who can only, of all the federal programs in what was passed, only through their children can they get maybe some food assistance. But these are folks who pay taxes and work hard and who are human beings and lives that matter. So I understand people's frustrations out there. I'm proud that I think we're the first big city in America to have an eviction moratorium. I'll be making, I think, another announcement tonight about making sure that the raises that people have on their rents can be controlled too. And I've asked the governor to look at, for non-rent controlled apartments, non-rent stabilized apartments, is there anything the state can do to relax Costa-Hawkins, the law that prevents local governments from doing anything more, so that we could take other apartments and make sure that people aren't evicted, and that we don't see rents go up during this crisis.
Thank you, Mayor Garcetti. We appreciate your being with us again today on Air Talk. We'll look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Thank you. Strength and love.
Thank you. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti joining us on Air Talk. We continue now with our daily check-in with a top physician somewhere in California to tell us about COVID-19, what we're learning about the coronavirus, and to answer your questions. We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. And it's our pleasure to welcome back from Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, specialist in infectious disease, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, thank you for joining us again. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry, for having me.
Well, let's start, first of all, with efforts to try and isolate antibodies from the virus. We've heard about some pilot projects to try and taking the plasma from the blood of people who've recovered from the virus, use that as a way of coming up with a treatment. What's the timetable for something like that in a best-case scenario?
Well, you know, sometimes in a pandemic, you have to try to accelerate clinical trials a little bit to get some information that will be helpful in terms of treating these patients. Antibody infusions, we do that for different types of diseases. These would be antibodies specific for SARS-CoV-2 from people who've recovered from the disease. I think that it's realistic to think that maybe in the next 2 months, we might have better information about that. We're not entirely sure that antibodies provide protection for this virus. We think so. And if it's like any other coronavirus, that's probably true. But we don't know the duration of that protection, and we also don't know some of the perils that could happen if you infuse antibodies into people without proper studies. So I think it's a couple months away. There are some very good studies that are being done right now in our country and also in Australia. And hopefully this will be something that we can use to sort of forestall some of the more catastrophic complications of this disease. But it is going to take some careful research. We don't want to do things that are going to harm people in an effort to try to save people.
All right. Also, Dr. Schreiner, wanted to ask you about the projection by Dr. Anthony Fauci that we could be seeing between 100,000 and 200,000 fatalities in this country from COVID-19. How are projections like that made?
Well, some of that information is based on epidemiologic calculations, looking at how many, something you may have heard about, different types of cofactors that are associated with calculating the infectivity of this virus. It does appear that this virus is somewhere around, it's called an R-naught value, and that is around two to three, something around in that range. So for every person who has a coronavirus infection, for every person they may contact, they could potentially infect two or three more people. So by looking at some of the incidence data in these large cities and even in the rural areas, you can get a rough estimate of the number of people that might become infected. Now, the thing we really have to remember is that the vast majority of people who do become infected with coronavirus survive and actually may have a very bad flu-like illness for a few days, but they actually survive. About 10% of people have a more serious course, maybe 15%, and then about 5% may have a very serious course and end up dying. So those calculations are very labile according to how the virus is spreading through the community. I would like to reiterate what Mayor Garcetti just said about the super importance of self-isolation and social distancing. It's a very old-fashioned tool, but it is the most effective tool in controlling an outbreak like this. If the virus doesn't have a host to jump to, it just has nowhere to go, and that's the end of that particular line of transmission. So I think those numbers are very scary. I think they are realistic, and I think Dr. Fauci, who's an excellent researcher and clinician, is proper in presenting that information so we really get an idea of where this thing could go.
What are we learning from the devastating outbreaks in Italy and Spain?
I think what we're learning is that the virus may behave differently in different populations as it moves through those areas. Italy has a largely older population. They have a fair amount of cardiovascular disease. And so those patients we know are already very susceptible and vulnerable to infection. Spain has similar populations. Both of those countries have a very high use of tobacco, and any kind of pulmonary disease may increase people's predisposition. But, you know, each population is different. As the virus moves through our own country, we have a very ethnically diverse country. We have a very medically diverse country in terms of patients that have comorbidities and other types of infections. So each time it enters a population, it may behave a little bit differently than it would in a homogeneous population, such as perhaps in China.
It would seem the 10% that you mentioned who will become quite ill with the effects of COVID-19, those individuals having access to rapid medical care is going to be key, because at least what we're hearing is that in many of these cases, within hours, you can have someone presenting comparatively mild symptoms go to serious compromise of the ability to breathe. And so it's going to be key for those folks, right, to be able to get into those ICUs fast.
Absolutely. And what happened in Italy and Spain in particular is that their systems were overwhelmed all at once. And so that's why the mortality may be higher in those countries. But it certainly could happen here. And we have certainly seen this at our own hospital, patients who present to the emergency room and only a few hours later are in extremis and have to be put on a ventilator, some of whom have unfortunately passed. So in some individuals, it can move very quickly. One of the things that we also are seeing in our country is a preponderance now of younger people that seem to have pretty devastating courses of disease. It wasn't thought that that was going to be a particularly vulnerable population coming out of China, but again, as this virus moves through different populations, we learn more and more about what are the risk factors associated with a bad outcome. And I think that will be very important data when we get over the hump with this disease to look at before we have to face another round of it, perhaps later in the year.
We're talking with Huntington Hospital in Pasadena's infectious disease specialist, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. She's taking your calls with your questions as well. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 893-KPECC. Look forward to your questions. We have listener Bob in Studio City who says, my son is being evacuated from India this week. We're in a high-risk group. What do we need to do to quarantine him? Dr. Schreiner?
Well, I think that what we're recommending right now is that anyone who's been on a plane or who's flying in from any country, doesn't matter whether it's India or someplace in South America or Africa, any place, that they actually try to self-quarantine for at least 14 days. It would probably be a good idea for them to measure their temperature on a daily basis and certainly look for symptoms like cough, achy bones, muscle aches, diarrhea, those sort of things. And, you know, Larry, that's actually a prudent thing for people to do who are returning from traveling anywhere these days. It's so easy to acquire different kinds of infections that as we go forward, I think that those are advice that we might want to give to somebody returning, regardless of whether there was a pandemic going on. But certainly right now, I'd recommend that individual stay away from the family for at least 14 days.
Dr. Schreiner, for those that don't have a fever, is that an indicator that they do not have COVID-19, or can someone be completely asymptomatic, including no fever, and still be carrying the virus?
Well, unfortunately, it does seem to be that the answer to that is yes. That may not be the rule. It may be more the exception. But that's a particularly dangerous situation in the community. And again, self-isolation for people who are returning from travel and social distancing and really sequestering people at home is so very important, because we just don't know how many individuals are walking around out there who are asymptomatic carriers and can transmit the disease in the absence of any obvious symptoms.
We'll continue with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope that even with the physical distancing that you're observing and spending the weekend at home and perhaps working from home today, that despite all of that, you've still had some good times sharing with family members and with friends while observing that distance. I just want to take a moment here as we're into the final 2 days of fundraising this spring for KPCC. We've suspended our typical in-depth fundraising, just giving you a couple times an hour these much briefer opportunities for you to support Air Talk on KPCC. And the show of support has been staggering. I don't think there's anything that compares to the brief time that we're talking about fundraising during Air Talk with response each time I bring you the phone number and ask for your support. This is a tremendous testament to what KPCC, through the wonderful staff I work with, is able to provide and the importance that it holds for you during this difficult time. So please right now make your contribution at 866-888-5722, or you can click and join at kpcc.org, 866-888-5722, or kpcc.org. I thank you so much for all your support. It just means a great deal to us. We'll continue with Dr. Schreiner, get her expertise with more listener questions, back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Maria in Alhambra says, if someone has mild symptoms, how are they being treated if they show up at a healthcare provider's office? And what should they do to care for themselves at home other than quarantining themselves? Dr. Schreiner?
Well, the first thing is that we'd like you to contact your physician by phone, because if you're only having mild symptoms, chances are they're not going to want you to show up at the doctor's office. We're trying to discourage patients from actually physically coming into the doctor's office, because that could be a potential area of transmission of disease. If you're having mild symptoms, then that would maybe be a low-grade temperature of 99, perhaps a little bit of a sore throat and some mild muscle aches, we recommend that you stay well hydrated with whatever you like to drink, water or juices, and take acetaminophen or Tylenol. It's probably prudent to avoid what we call non-steroidal agents, such as ibuprofen or Motrin, Advil, Aleve, those sort of things. There's some data that may suggest that those medications may stimulate the expression of receptors that the virus likes to attach to. So acetaminophen is the way to go if you're having symptoms and you need some relief, but plenty of rest, keeping yourself isolated from your family, covering your mouth when you cough, and of course, excellent, excellent hand washing.
Now, we've had other medical experts who've said they thought the concerns about ibuprofen were not legitimate, that was based on some very anecdotal stuff that really wasn't borne out. But you think it is worth avoiding?
I think we don't know at this point. And I think in light of that, we tend to like to use acetaminophen as a pain medication for several reasons. The first, it's not as irritating to the stomach. And if you have other types of abnormalities, high blood pressure or problems with your kidneys, then ibuprofen-containing substances can be somewhat problematic. The data, I think, is still very murky about that, and I would agree that it's not a clear problem that we've identified. But I think that in light of all of the things that we don't know, acetaminophen is the better pain medication to look to.
All right. I also wanted to ask you about the use. The FDA has approved the off-label use of hydroxychloroquine sulfate and chloroquine sulfate, the antimalarials, for treatment. When is that called for?
You know, Larry, that's really an important question. Unfortunately, as Dr. Fauci alluded to several weeks ago, I really don't think there's a lot of good data that supports its use. We are using it more in patients that are actually in the hospital. There is a lot of scientific data that shows that if you put those medications in a petri dish with the virus, it does kill the virus. But both personally and in the literature, we've not had much experience. We've not had much good outcome with patients that are taking hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. Most of that was based on some studies that were done in France, very small studies, and also some in China. And those studies were largely anecdotal. They were not well-controlled studies. There is a danger using those two medications together. They can cause heart block, which can lead to some pretty catastrophic side effects. And I know certainly at our own institution, we just haven't seen a whole lot of benefit with doing that. So and the unfortunate thing is, too, many people take Plaquenil for other diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis, and now, of course, it's in a huge short supply for people who really do need to take that medication. So at this point, I think that the efficacy of those medications is really still very much in question.
Silas, thanks you for joining us today, and said, I heard the guidelines around face masks are changing. Now they're saying that the general population should wear them. What are your thoughts on us wearing face masks?
Well, I think that, again, this is a function as we move into a surge of patients and the virus becomes much more common in the community. I think most epidemiologists and infectious disease specialists feel that at this point anybody could be infected and may not even be symptomatic. And it's those, and so for that reason, we think it's probably prudent for people to wear, say, face masks when they're out in areas where they may encounter people, perhaps at the grocery store or in other stores. When you're walking your dog along the street and you're able to keep 10 feet away from someone out in the fresh air, you don't need to wear a face mask. But a lot of this may be actually more for protecting your, not so much protecting you from other people, but protecting other, protecting you from spraying your mucus secretions onto somebody else. And I think that we've now changed our masking policy at Huntington. Most of our staff now are masked. And I think that as the virus becomes much more common, you just don't know who could have it. And so masking may be helpful. But hand washing is still one of the most critical things.
So it sounds like you're saying if you go to the supermarket where you might not always be able to keep that buffer, a face mask could be beneficial. Out walking the dog where you're keeping significant difference, it's not like you're going to pick it up just from the air around you.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Also, are surgical masks sufficient, or in what cases should someone use an N95?
Well, as many people know, our N95 shortage is a critical problem in the ability to handle incoming patients into the hospital. So N95s really should be reserved for medical personnel. Surgical masks are probably adequate for general use. They are not adequate for someone encountering a patient who has active coronavirus infection. But we don't generally recommend N95s for the general public. They are a hugely valuable resource for medical personnel. And again, the scarcity of them is making this a big challenge. Again, if everybody wears a mask, the likelihood that they're going to transmit infected particles to somebody else is smaller, and surgical masks are probably adequate to do that.
Are you getting some donations at Huntington of N95s from the construction industry or manufacturing where they have them for industrial purposes?
We have a collection area at Huntington Collections, and we have been receiving wonderful donations from very generous people. I believe construction companies have contributed, as well as private individuals. Some of those are N95 masks. We have a lot of surgical masks that are being donated, which can be very useful for general use while walking around in non-patient areas. And so the hospital is very grateful for all of the donations that people have stepped up to make, and I know that other hospitals are in the same situation.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're talking with Huntington Hospital, Pasadena's infectious disease specialist, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. I don't know whether you'd have the answer to this. It's a public health question, but an interesting one. Roger asked it on the AirTalk Facebook page. Given the widespread adoption of physical distancing and hygiene awareness, has routine seasonal flu decreased?
I think we're going to see that. I think there are some hidden benefits, not only just flu, but you know, there are a whole host of other coronaviruses and human metapneumovirus, rhinoviruses, that can cause pretty devastating disease, especially in vulnerable populations. So I think with this kind of implementation, we may see a decline in that, and that will be a nice benefit. as influenza still kills 18, 20,000 people a year in the United States.
Talk with Anna in Whittier. You're on Air Talk.
Yes, hi. I had heard that people taking blood pressure medication, in particular an ACE inhibitor, may be more vulnerable to getting sicker if they happen to catch the virus. Have you heard anything about that?
That is a concern. As you may know, Anna, that the virus attaches to a receptor site called an ACE2 receptor in the lungs. And so there has been some concern that, patients that are taking blood pressure medicines that are ACE inhibitors, perhaps that would either enhance or even maybe actually prevent infection. We don't really know which one or the other, but I think that data is really not available at this point. We certainly don't want to see an increase in people having strokes or heart attacks because they're not taking their blood pressure medications. And I don't think at this point there's enough data to make any comment about whether taking an ACE inhibitor is really a dangerous thing to do in this setting. But it is something that we're looking at, and I think hopefully in the next few weeks we'll have some more information about that.
Well, and people stopping taking their blood pressure meds obviously has some potentially serious consequences.
Exactly. That's why we don't want people to change their regular medication routines at all until we have more information. It's so very important that we collect good scientific data about all of these things so that we can make the right recommendations.
Joanna in East Hollywood asks, how effective are the cloth masks, these ones people are making?
Well, they certainly are not masks that we would want to use in the setting of someone with active infection for our healthcare workers. Cloth masks are very variable. Some polypropylene masks may be a little less permeable than regular cotton masks. Obviously, if you're able to breathe easier, then that means it might be more porous. Some of these masks can absorb and the virus can stay on the mask for a while. So they may be somewhat helpful. They're probably better than nothing, but they certainly should not be used in the setting where there's a great deal of known disease.
Just a piece of news, Spain is enforcing even tighter stay-at-home rules for its 47 million residents. They've overtaken China as the nation with the third highest number of reported infections in the world. Dr. Schreiner, are you confident in the numbers that we're getting out of China, or do you think it likely that their numbers are significantly higher than reported?
I don't think we have any way of knowing that, Larry. I think WHO has been into China a few times fairly recently and have tried to sort of verify some of the statistics that they've put out. We hope that they're being transparent about their numbers because we're trying to use the Chinese model in terms of our own numbers and where we what are the problems that we might encounter. But I don't think there's really a good way of knowing that, and we have to sort of be again, watch the virus, how it moves in other countries like Italy and Spain, where we know that they have pretty reliable transparency with the numbers.
Ed in Studio City asks, do you know what the transmission mechanism would be for asymptomatic carriers? If they're not coughing or sneezing, how is it being passed on?
Well, again, you don't necessarily have to have a cough or a sneeze. You know, people, mucous membranes, and sometimes material can get on contact on surfaces. They can occasionally, if they're talking, people can expel mucus. Sometimes I think there was a horrific story in the New York Times this morning about, or maybe it was in the LA Times, about a choir up in Washington that had a great deal of a coronavirus infection because when you're singing, there's a lot of oral material that I guess can be sort of suspended in the air. So those sort of things are of concern. And this virus is quite good at invading other mucosal tissue and is pretty aggressive with that. So that's why we are seeing probably community transmission from asymptomatic people, even though they may not be coughing or sneezing.
Carlos in Van Nuys asked about the lag time in testing. Apparently, he was tested by the county. We don't know what the date of that was, but how long is it running typically now to get, with a backlog at some labs, to get those results?
Well, happily, there are more labs coming online that are able to test. LabCorp has come online for some testing, and there are now so many in-house testing facilities. So we're hoping that Huntington will have one fairly soon. So we're seeing a little bit of a shorter lag time. Quest is able to process more lab tests fairly quickly. But there's still a great deal of variability. In some places, it can be 24 hours. There still are 3 or 4 day waits, I think, for some of the larger mass testing areas, that's still a problem. We still haven't quite finessed our testing capabilities yet, but it is happening more frequently and happening more rapidly.
All right. We also have a listener who is taking an immunosuppressant, Taltz, which is an injectable, wondering if there's significantly higher risk for people who are taking those kinds of medications.
You know, the answer is probably, and certainly that person would be included in someone who would be a higher risk person. We are very concerned about patients that are taking any type of immunosuppressive agents, whether they're corticosteroids or some of the biologic agents. Ironically enough, there is a medication that's a biologic agent that we are actually using for some of the patients that have this terrible raging, what we call a cytokine storm, and we have used it in some patients with marginal improvement, but certainly people that are taking immunosuppressive medications for rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis or other maladies does put them at a little higher risk.
Just one more question for you from Jeanette in Valencia. This we get almost daily about the safety of ordering takeout food.
Well, it is a dilemma. I think that, again, if you can have the food put in a container and then carefully remove the container, perhaps wipe that down before you actually touch it, and then take the food out of the container and put it into your own dishes, that's probably pretty safe. We don't think the virus is transmitted from infected food per se, although uncooked foods, maybe salads and so forth, could be perhaps a potential source. But also ingesting the virus into your gastrointestinal tract may not be a method of infection. We don't think so. The acid in your stomach probably would neutralize the virus, but we just don't really have any information about that. So I think takeout is a good option to kind of keep our businesses afloat, and we certainly want to support our businesses as much as we can, but it does require a little bit of finesse at home in handling the cartons.
All right, very good. And just quickly, at Huntington right now, about what capacity are you running at?
Well, we're able to handle what we're getting right now. We are preparing for the an increased number of patients every night. We certainly have a slightly higher number. And the big, you know, factor really, I think, for most, like most hospitals, are going to be the ventilators and also the staff. You know, our staff are working very, very hard, and that's going to be a very critical problem. I think Mayor Garcetti alluded to that. We can build hospitals physically, but it's the people that run it. That's really what the hospital is. And so right now, we're functioning fine, and we've prepared for a big surge, but it's just hard to know when that's going to be and how big is it's going to be, and will we have enough personnel and equipment to handle it.
All right. One of my cousins is over there working at Huntington as a nurse, so I know so many people working very, very hard and dedicated at hospitals and urgent care clinics and physicians' offices all over Southern California. Dr. Schreiner, thank you very much for your work, and we really appreciate your spending this time with us.
Thank you, Larry. My pleasure.
Thanks. Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Just want to remind you how vital your financial support is for AirTalk right now. We only have today and tomorrow to raise a total amount of $1 million during the course of this spring member period on KPCC. We suspended our typical in-depth fundraising. Instead, we're just doing a couple of very brief mentions to ask you, please, to come forward. We want to be able to keep our staffing fully here at KPCC. We want to keep the level of coverage as it's been throughout the course of the spread of COVID-19. That requires raising $1 million during this period. We're at 866-888-5722 or kpcc.org to make your contribution now. And I also want to stress that we know how hard it is for many, many people listening right now. If you're someone who's lost your job or you've been furloughed, you're not getting paid and you don't know when things are going to change. We are deeply sympathetic with you. We have people in our families who fit this circumstance. We have friends, people that are close to us. You are on our minds and on our hearts. So please, when I make this request for financial support, we're talking very directly to those of us fortunate enough to still have a job right now, who are still being paid right now, who don't have the deep level of financial insecurity that so many of our listeners do right now. And I just want to let you know, we're very conscious of that, more than conscious. We're deeply concerned about that. But for those of you that can afford to fund this service now, I ask you please to do it at 866-888-5722 or kpecc.org. We'll be back in 90 seconds.